to see me through. Sometimes it seems the going is just too rough. Can't think of home no matter what I do. Now and then it seems like life is just too much. But you got the love I need to see me through. When food is gone, you are my daily need. Oh. When friends are gone, out of my savior's love.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna in, once again, sunny and beautiful Laguna Beach. I'm your host, Kim Sage, and I am a therapist in Newport Beach and currently completing my doctorate in clinical psychology. I work with individuals and couples and teens and children and occasionally some families. So while we're on the show today, if you have any thoughts or questions or any feedback, please feel free to tweet me at K-Sage Psychology. That's K-S-A-G-E Psychology. So the show is really Loved with Kim Sage. It's really a show about love and relationships, which we're going to explore through guest interviews, call or writing questions, and often through analyzing films and the relationship between that experience we have and our unconscious mind, the way that gets interpreted. My dissertation is actually on using films in therapy, and so this is sort of a present topic in my mind all the time, and I've always had a huge passion for films, and I love breaking down the psychological content and analyzing the process that can be triggered in our own minds and in our lives. I think that films have this great power to ignite a spark within you, whether it's to see something you had never seen before or experience some truth about yourself. And sometimes they function just as a window into an aspect of life that we've never experienced before and that we don't know anything about. And they can also create the bridge in our mind that forces us to think about how we might respond if we were in the same situation as the character on screen. That was actually the case for me in a film called Still Alice, starring Julianne Moore, Alec Baldwin, and Kristen Stewart, among a few others. The film is really about a very successful and intelligent woman who develops early onset Alzheimer's. And in a few minutes, I'm going to welcome a guest to the show who is a therapist and, among other things, runs groups for adult children of aging parents. And I thought she'd be a great resource for us in terms of working with caregivers and families. And so in the film, Julianne is nominated for an Oscar. And she just won the BAFTA award, which is basically the British version of our Oscars. So she has an incredible performance. She plays a linguistics professor Dr. Alice Howland, and she's at Columbia University. She's a wife and a mother of three basically grown children. They're all out of the house, at least. Alice develops early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 50 and begins to find her memory and speech and identity slipping away. Early onset Alzheimer's actually can occur as early as 30 years old, although it's very rare. Early onset Alzheimer's only affects about 4 to 5% of the actual population. But Alzheimer's itself impacts about 5.2 million Americans. So just to give you a little bit of background about the film, everyone involved in the project really seemed to have some personal experience tied to it. And I think you can kind of feel that. The film was based from a book written by Lisa Genova, who holds a PhD from Harvard in neuroscience and works in the area of dementia. And Lisa travels worldwide speaking about Alzheimer's, traumatic brain injury, and autism. The film was also co-directed by filmmakers who are partners, and one of them was diagnosed with ALS prior to making the movie. And interestingly, it was executive produced by Maria Shriver, whose father, Sergeant Shriver, developed Alzheimer's. So it really felt like everyone involved in that project had some connection and personal stake with regard to the film. Just to briefly discuss what Alzheimer's is, I think most of us know, but it's basically a type of dementia, which dementia is really just a general term for a decline in mental ability, a decline that is severe enough to impact your daily life. You also might hear found under the category of neurocognitive disorders. That's sort of the new term that's been coming up. And all of those really just mean that this type of decline is associated with changes in the brain that cause problems with memory, thinking, and behavior. And the real key here is that the symptoms get worse over time, and they eventually interfere with just daily tasks. Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. It takes approximately about 60 to 80% of the cases that involve dementia. And while it is not a normal part of aging, aging is the greatest risk factor, and the majority of those who have it are generally 65 years and up. So in the film, of course, this is rare, but the experience of what happens is not necessarily that rare. There is no cure at present, but there are some medications which can slow down and the symptoms and help address those. So in the film, Alice finds herself in the beginning of the film starting to lose her train of thought and lose words. And remember, she's a linguistics professor, so she's really, you know, usually on her game. And she finds herself even lost during a run that's probably a run she's taken a million times on the campus of Columbia. And from there, we watch her receive her diagnosis and begin to watch her decline and witness the impact the disease has not only on her, but on her family members. And so I want to use the film today just to talk about the many factors associated with Alzheimer's and the storyline. And on that note, I'd like to welcome my guest, Marnie Riley, to the show to discuss the film and discuss the impact of Alzheimer's on the character and on her family. Welcome, Marnie.
Thank you so much, Kim. It's great to be here.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here. To give a little background about Marnie, Marnie is a licensed marriage and family therapist in private practice in Irvine, and she loves working collaboratively, I'm having a funny time with words today myself, with clients and navigating life transitions, relationship issues, gender identity issues, grief and loss, and caregiving. And Marnie facilitates a group on adult children of aging parents and has additional certification in grief and bereavement. So she's really a great resource for us today. So Marnie, I want to discuss the different aspects of the film, but I want to start with the characters. Let's start with Alice herself. Of all the things, she's a linguistics professor, as I mentioned. And so this woman is really defined by her intelligence, by her words. And that seems particularly cruel to me in some way. And I think that makes it dynamic in the film. What were your thoughts about that as you began to watch this woman begin to face something like this?
One of the things that really struck me, Kim, was that her neurologist in the film mentioned that actually her diagnosis could seem, or the progression of her disease could seem very quick because there was enough time. She had delayed the symptoms because of all of the cognitive work she was doing. She was very intelligent. She was very engaged. And so it almost seemed as if her symptoms were really accelerated because she had staved them off for so long.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. And it made me a little bit nervous thinking to people who are intelligent, can they sort of prolong the diagnosis? Because we have all these cheats we can create for ourselves now, too, with technology, you know, reminders and things are at our fingertips. So even from a technological perspective, combined with her intellect, it makes sense that she was able to potentially not recognize the symptoms for a while. Yeah. I thought it was interesting in terms of, this brings up the idea of how do we define ourselves? So this is a woman who was defined by her achievements. How do you think that plays out in our lives in terms of how we define ourselves and then finding ourselves in a situation like this?
Well, her identity was completely rocked. And in the film, I don't know how long it took for the progression to happen. I know they did say it was very fast and it seemed very fast. And I think that that probably plays a role as well. The shock of a diagnosis like that, especially with someone so young, where it seemed to come out of the blue, I think that her identity, you know, just dealing with the shock of that, I don't know that she even had time to really adjust to this new identity before she somewhat lost her identity.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think that's what's interesting to me is that we spend so much of our time trying to define ourselves by, you know, the way we look, what we do, what we accomplish, what we achieve. And when you face a moment like this, it doesn't really matter anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's the reality. We spend so much time chasing after these things. But once you lose those things, all you have is, you know, you.
Mm-hmm. Right. And your relationships. I know that in the film, well, she had defined herself as someone who was very intelligent and somebody who gave back, who was a professor and who used their speaking ability to teach others and to give to others. And she still did that even after the diagnosis at the Alzheimer's Association meeting. So she was able to still use her skill set, maybe not in the same way, not quite as sharp as she once had, but she still was using that identity as a professor even later on in the diagnosis.
That's true, and that was incredible to watch her really fight for that as the film progressed. Mm-hmm. I agree. Did you find yourself imagining, if that were you, what that might be like?
I didn't. I was imagining it more from a caregiver perspective. Maybe that's my own self-protection, my own ego self-protecting in that case, because it certainly could be me, right? It could be any of us. Mm-hmm. But I was looking at it more from a caregiver perspective, and I was relating to her children and to her husband more. It's funny that you asked that because I did not really put myself in her place.
But you did put yourself in some position mm-hmm. of the character, right? Mm-hmm. So do you think that's based on your own experience with something like this or in terms of you seeing, because you do work with the caregiving issue a lot. Mm-hmm. So maybe for you that makes sense. That's where you went.
In the therapy group that I run, many of the caregivers are, well, they're all adult children of aging parents, so I don't have the spouses in this group. And many of them are caring for a parent who does have some kind of dementia, usually Alzheimer's. Not everyone in the group. Some people have parents with stroke or other physical issues. But yes, so I definitely hear and see a lot of the impact that Alzheimer's has on the entire family system.
Yeah, it's got to be significantly devastating at times, you know. So where do the spouses go? Are there support groups for spouses specifically? Do they tend to get in a different group or how does that work?
There are, and actually locally, there are a lot of caregiving groups in general. The Alzheimer's Association in Irvine is a fantastic resource and they have many, many groups. And all of their services, education, are free. My particular group, I really wanted to focus on the adult children just to have a very specific place for the issues that the kids are facing. because I think that the dynamics that a spouse has with their loved one who is suffering from Alzheimer's or whatever it might be, is a different dynamic than the kids have.
Yes, I can imagine. What would be the number one or the greatest issue that comes up with children with aging parents in this situation?
I think that sometimes there is a tendency to fall back into the role of child and parent, like as if they were kids again. This can be particularly strong of a sense if the adult child moves back into the childhood home to care for the parent. So it's easy to fall back into those roles. And I know that the caregiver, they often, you know, the caregivers in my group or that I've worked with do not want to be the parent of their parent. Of course not. But somehow they have to readjust because they do have, they have to readjust that relationship. And that's really tricky. It could be that their relationship as a child growing up with their parent was wonderful, fantastic, nurturing. And that brings up a lot of pain of loss as the parent loses some of their memory. However, sometimes there are really difficult relationships. And so the adult child caregiver is thrown into a situation where they're caring for someone who maybe wasn't very nurturing as a parent to them and maybe even abusive.
Wow, that's got to be incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the film does a good job of showing that everybody has a different response to someone's illness. So, for example, her husband, you know, I've really felt like all along the way, he's sort of leaning in, but mostly denying. You know, at first it's like, oh, it's not possible. You're too young, which, of course, that's a, I would imagine, a pretty common response. But throughout the film, and I read this in a bunch of reviews, you know, Alec Baldwin does a great job of playing this, that, you know, he's trying to be there. But I just felt like there was this piece of him that was just missing. And because I could imagine how, if you really look at that, you have to look at your own vulnerability to that. So, you know, and then the children, of course, have a different response, and each of her children have different responses. Yeah,
they did. I felt that Kristen Stewart's character, it was interesting how compassionate she seemed to be. And when I say compassionate, I mean that in the sense of compassionate communication. So there was a scene where Kristen Stewart, where they were all sitting around the table, and Kristen Stewart, she just said, look, her character just said, look, let's just do what mom wants to do. Why do we have to fight her on this? Why don't we just let her put the information into her phone if that's what's making her feel comfortable? Mm-hmm. And the other daughter, played by Kate Bosworth, Anna, she was insisting that her mother not do that. And so there became this power struggle, which kind of was almost as if Julianne Moore's character, Alice, wasn't even there. And I think for the Alice character, that could feel really horrible, like almost like she's invisible and she's being talked about. And that loss of control would probably feel completely overwhelming.
Definitely. I can imagine. On that note, we're going to take a quick break, but I want to come back and talk a little bit more about the role that Kristen Stewart plays in the film. I think she does an amazing job, and definitely her character responds in a way that maybe in the beginning of the film you wouldn't have expected. So when we get back, we'll talk more about the film Still Alice with therapist Marnie Riley.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna. Today we're talking about the film Still Alice, and we have a guest, which is a great therapist friend of mine, Marnie Riley's joining us, and we're just talking about what it's like to potentially put yourself in the situation of having a caregiver or actually even your own life change through a significant diagnosis like Alzheimer's. We were talking before the break about the relationship between the daughter, who's played by Kristen Stewart, and the other children. So Kristen Stewart's character is trying to be an actor. That's really what the path she wants to follow. And her other two siblings are quite on the academic path, much like her parents. And so, here she is, this creative soul in this family with a different sort of agenda in terms of how they live their lives. And so in the beginning, we feel this little bit of tension and conflict between sort of mom's goals for her and her goals for her, which I think is a fairly common, could be fairly common dynamic. But in the film, she actually ends up being the person who becomes her mom's caregiver. And because her life is less structured, she almost has a little more flexibility. You know, one is an attorney, pregnant, the other one's a physician. But you can see in the beginning that this piece of their fracture and their relationship based on mom's goals for her are different. And then it comes up the idea that I was reading a bunch of reviews, and they were also talking about this, that Julianne, almost in some level as the mom, tries to sort of manipulate Kristen, and I'm going to play a clip in a minute, using her illness almost to sort of, are you sure you need to go to college? You know, I'm dying. And sort of said jokingly, but it's also said more seriously in the film. What was your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction was not so much about that comment, although that was funny. And even Kristen Stewart's, she commented, Lydia, the character of Lydia, commented, look, mom, you can't use that. You can't use that to manipulate me. And she said, sure, I can. I'm your mom.
Exactly. That's my job.
But it did strike me that Lydia became the caregiver. Two thirds of caregivers are women. And I see this a lot where there's a dynamic of the siblings, and the person that kind of gets picked, shall we say, or self-appoints as the caregiver, the primary caregiver, when it's the siblings, it's interesting because it tends to be, in general, a woman, and it also tends to be the person who is characteristically the most nurturing and the most obvious pick in that family. And in this family, it seemed like she was it. She got tagged. I mean, she did choose to make that choice as well, but it was just interesting that she was the one who became the caregiver.
It was. Have you found in your groups that some of these children were the, I don't want to use the word black sheep, but I heard that word to describe her role a little bit. Are they not necessarily the chosen child? Is it often a different child? You know, you hear this about the favorite, it's not the favorite, things like that.
I think often it tends to be the person who is the most nurturing and thinking about other people. And that's tough because there can be a lot of resentment around that. The person who maybe is the most natural fit for the role, while they might choose it or they might accept it, sometimes there's resentment that the other siblings are not really pitching in or even being difficult and not helping or somehow disagreeing with the primary caregiver's choices. So that dynamic is pretty common.
I can see that. And in the film, it plays out. I mean, you know, there's just the other lives of the other children are very busy in terms of those types of things. And you're right, you referenced earlier, there's a little bit of conflict that occurs and how everyone's viewing how it should be handled. Mm-hmm. I do want to try to play the clip from the film here where we talk about, they're having a conversation at lunch about mom's sort of goals for Kristen Stewart's character. So let's see if I can get that up.
Don't you think it's time you reconsider things? You're so smart. You're so much more than you can do in life. Like going to college.
we're going to take a break on that one because it's not happening right now. Basically, the clip is that mom is once again bringing up this idea. And I can imagine at the end of your life, you have all these wishes for your children or people that you love. And so are you trying to wrap up loose ends? Are you trying to get them to follow their dreams that really are your dreams? Have you thought about that? Or people talk about sort of the end of life goals and what that looks like for the caregivers to witness, maybe them not achieving those goals, or, you know, the end coming too quickly?
Well, of course, it's different for everybody, and it depends on the diagnosis and how sudden the changes are cognitively or physically. I think that there's a huge adjustment it's for everyone. I don't know that it's just for people that are in the later stages of life. I think we all, as we age, we realize that, wow, maybe we're not going to be president of the United States if that had been our, you know, our dream, or maybe this is it. And also, I think that we realize that we aren't so special. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but we're all just doing the best that we can, and things happen to us that we don't expect. It could be a sudden illness of a family member or ourselves, and it's not quote unquote supposed to happen. Julianne Moore's character, Alice, she was not supposed to have this diagnosis and have her life completely altered. And yet it happens, and we all have to adjust to these things that come thrown at us.
I agree. I think that's the hardest part. It's the joy of life, and also the difficulty is we really don't know what tomorrow brings. And for me, and I want to discuss this in a few minutes, but that was really the message of the film. You know, it really is about your today, because you don't know what happens tomorrow. For you, was there any particular part of the film that resonated the most with you?
I think the very last scene. It I might even well up talking about it now, seriously, because that the last scene where Julianne Moore's character is quite advanced in her dementia and her memory loss and cognitive loss, and her daughter is really trying to connect with her on some level and is there for her, and they both are having to totally adjust their own ways of viewing their relationship, because for both of those characters, their relationship to each other has altered dramatically. So that was really poignant to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, it's a difficult movie to watch. I think I found myself crying about 15 minutes into the film, and I was by myself, so it was like that thing where you're trying to hold back the sobbing, and I snuck in. It was one of those busy films, you know, the seats were all filled and you're trying to find a spot, and so yeah, it's a tough film, because so much of it is one of those things that I think all of us fear, something we love or could happen to us. You know, it's hard to watch, and it's a beautiful unfolding in the film, I believe, of the role that she plays and the way she plays it. You know, mm-hmm. It's very subtle. You know, it's not over the top responsive to things, but you, in those little moments, you can see the shifts occurring. One of the things I do want to talk about, which is, it's not, you know, I'm not giving anything away, because all the reviews talk about this issue too. First of all, is the shame. One of the lines she says is, "I wish I had cancer instead." What are your thoughts about that?
My thoughts are, you know, what comes up for me is thinking about our brain as separate somehow from our body. Our society somehow, it's okay, not okay, but it's somehow sanctioned to have something wrong with our body. If we have a flu, we go to the doctor. If we have cancer, we go to the doctor. But if there's something with our brain, maybe we have some symptoms of depression or anxiety, or maybe what the character of Alice is experiencing, somehow it's separate and there's a stigma attached, almost as if there's something wrong in a mental way, like someone's crazy or someone's loss of cognition means that they aren't intelligent or something along those lines. So I find it really interesting that there is this disconnect. And even though therapy has come a long way and is not as stigmatized, in fact, I think it's great. I think everyone should go to therapy.
Yeah, we're not biased.
Not at all. But, you know, there still are some people who feel like that it's somehow a fault of theirs. There's something wrong with them.
I completely agree. And it's heartbreaking because I think it keeps a lot of people out of our offices or anyone that does in any kind of healing or helping profession, regardless of what you do and the way you go about it. There is a lot of shame attached to any cognitive, technically related illness. And people suffer in silence and alone, and they don't have to, you know. And therapy is also hard work. I mean, we know that there are some weeks where we've all been there thinking, oh, I just really don't want to go in there. And I always say that's when you really should be there, right? That's the session you should definitely show up for. But I did feel sad. Like, I could totally relate to that, especially for her, because she was so intelligent that the idea that she was going to lose that was such a big part of her. And that really sets up, it did for me internally, and it definitely does in the film, that at a certain point, fairly early on in the diagnosis, Julianne begins to create a file on her computer for herself, where she basically provides instructions to herself to take her own life. And she even goes so far as, you know, she's still very functioning to get the pills. She hides them in a drawer. She provides instructions, and she sets up some criteria, which are, okay, when you can no longer answer these questions, this is the time to end your life. There's no question that suicide, or even assisted suicide, which I was reading about in terms of how does a person have the capacity to choose when they lose their capacity, right? Mm-hmm. What's your experience with that aspect of a progressive disease like this and the role that might play for patients and for caregivers?
Specifically, you're talking about suicide?
Right, in terms of, because the film, she bungles the attempt, you know, she tries. And, it, you know, I even read a review saying, oh, it kind of becomes comical. It's actually kind of really difficult to watch. She has to keep getting the computer and keep, you know, holding it to go up the stairs to follow the instructions because she can't even remember what to do once she gets up there. I'm wondering how much that comes into play in terms of people taking their own lives, or even, you know, I could see a caregiver on some level wanting it to be over because it's so difficult.
I haven't had the experience of any of the caregivers that I've worked with talking about suicide or, you know, their parents' suicide. I think that when people are, in this case, she knew that there was going to be a major decline. And so she was making decisions as somebody who wasn't actually living through the situation. In that sense, it was pretty tragic that her previous self was trying as much as possible to maintain that control over herself that had the progressed disease. And was unable to do so and on her own terms. But I'm not really sure that the character, once she had progressed, was still wanting that. I think she was following the yellow brick road, following the instructions, but I'm not sure she was really in a place where she wanted what her earlier self had wanted.
Yeah, because there's a scene where she talks about, I have a few things I want to experience before I sort of lose myself. And one of them is I want to hold my grandchildren. And even when she comes in to hold her daughter's child, she can still connect. She said, I still know how to hold a baby. You know, they're almost hesitant to give it to her. And that does sort of question that moment where, yes, she may not be who she was, but she's still able to take this pleasure and joy in this human experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, that whole topic of how do you choose for yourself when you aren't the same person that you were, when you don't know where the path's going to lead, right? So in the beginning, she's choosing it because she's just determined, this is where I'm going to end up. I'm not going to live through this. And then later, you know, she doesn't really have the ability fully cognitively to make that decision. And at a certain point, a person is incapable of that, right? So,
well, even if it's not a cognitive issue that someone who is ailing is dealing with, maybe it's a physical issue, maybe it's chronic pain, you know, none of us are in their body. None of us know exactly the experience of what it is like to be somebody else. And I can imagine that it would be extremely difficult to adjust to chronic pain, disability. And, you know, so there's different ways to look at it. Somebody might say, my life isn't what it was, and therefore that's not okay with me. But then some people might find some way to still, like we're talking about with Julianne Moore's character of holding the baby, still there are joys, still there is some quality of life in the present moment, even if it's not what it had been. It's not easy though.
Yeah. And on that note, we're going to come back and talk about the present as sort of the last part of this segment in terms of this film. So we're taking a quick break, listening to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna. Welcome back to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna in Laguna Beach. Today, I'm speaking with therapist Marnie Riley about the film Still Alice and about concepts around caregiving and illness and things like that. I read a beautiful quote about this film, and it said that this story was really a meditation on the end of our lives. And I thought, wow, that's incredible, because you start to think about what do you want, that life is precious, you don't know what tomorrow brings. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I was thinking about how Alice is, her life becomes the moment. It becomes the present moment. And how, in a way, as tragic as the story is and as painful to watch, how beautiful that is, that she really is in the moment. And I think that people who do have Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, often it can be more painful to be the family members or the loved ones of that person who are seeing a decline and remembering what the person had been like and mourning the loss of that person in a way, that psychological loss. That can be a lot more painful than being the person that's in the grips of Alzheimer's.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I can imagine what that's like. When you think about your experiences and working with this population, what has working with caregiving issues taught you about your life or about yourself?
Well, that's a big question. I feel so honored to be able to witness and to hear other stories and to walk this journey with them. When the caregivers that I work with are discussing their pain, their frustration, their overwhelm, their joy, it's not all negative. I think that a lot of people find ways of adjusting. I think that resilience is probably the biggest thing I've seen, and how people can grieve the loss of something that's gone and adjust to what is now. There's a researcher named Pauline Boss, and she wrote a book called Ambiguous Loss, and that concept to me is really an interesting one. Ambiguous loss is not the loss of someone through death. That's very concrete. Our society, when someone dies, our society has all these ways to support the survivors, bringing casseroles to the house, wakes, funerals, a lot of ritual. With ambiguous loss, it can actually be more difficult because there aren't these really concrete distinctions. There are two kinds of ambiguous loss. One is psychological and one is physical. So someone like in Alzheimer's, they could be physically still there and yet psychologically they're gone, and or the person that they had been is gone. There's also the other way, like for instance, if somebody loses, a child is abducted, let's say. The child is not physically there, but of course, very psychologically there in the family. So these caregiving, that's an ambiguous loss. You're constantly having to adjust to new losses and changes every day. And that's where, to bring it back to that resilience, I think that's the thing that I think is most poignant. Mm.
So how do you help people maintain or seek or find that resilience if they don't have it? What kinds of things do you use in this sort of a group that are helpful?
Mm-hmm. Well, just the support of the other people is huge. Caregiving can be incredibly isolating. You know, you're with the person you're caring for maybe all the time. So your life is almost sacrificed sometimes for the other. And knowing that you're not the only one doing this is a big thing. I think also there can be some guilt. Let's say a caregiver has a mother with Alzheimer's and says to them, "Mom, remember, we're going to the doctor today." Then realizes, "Oh, you know, I shouldn't have said that. Maybe I shouldn't have said remember." But also finding that grace to forgive themselves and realize, you know what, I'm doing my best. I'm exhausted too. And maybe next time they won't use the word remember. They'll just say something more compassionate or just say, "Oh, you know, we're going to the doctor." I think sometimes when I hear caregiving stories, that are really rosy, I feel ambivalent about that. I recently heard a talk by a woman who was a caregiver for many years, and she said it was, you know, the best years of her life caring for her husband and how fabulous it was, and she wouldn't give it up for ever anything, and she learned so much. And in one way, that's great. Good for her. I'm thrilled to hear that. That's beautiful. But I think that when caregivers hear that story, they might compare themselves to that and then feel guilty, like, oh, maybe they're not doing enough, or somehow feel shame that they feel overwhelmed and exhausted and angry and resentful. And so I like to take to really normalize some of those feelings.
I think that's so important, and that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this show, because I want to have real conversations where we're honest about our struggles. And I'd mentioned on an earlier show, you know, all these people have expert opinions and you must do this and that, and it all, oftentimes the standard is so high, whether it's authentically set high or inauthentically set high, you know, we're all doing the best we can. And I think you're right, it's so important to be validated that however you're doing it, it's okay. There's always tomorrow. You can get up and do it differently tomorrow, you know?
Yes, because the caregivers do not need the extra burden of feeling like they're not doing it well enough.
Yeah.
There is such thing as good enough. They're there.
Totally agree with you on that when we had a good enough parenting show, because I think that, you know, we all need to be real about our struggles. I think it makes us stronger. You know, and having that support where you can not paint the rosy picture all of the time. Not that you should maybe always focus on the negative, because that's not good either, right? But there's a balance somewhere between the reality of these situations. I would imagine that self-care and maintaining self-care would be a huge part of being a caregiver. Do you have that component you talk about a lot?
Absolutely, for sure. I came up with a list of some things that people could do. And I realized when I handed out the list to my caregivers, one of them said, oh, is light a candle and take a bubble bath on this list? And I started laughing. She's like, yeah, that's not going to happen. There's no time for that.
Oh.
So I don't mean it as these trivial things that, oh, you know, life is going to be great if you just light a candle. But there are actually little things that people can do to reset. I talk about going to the bathroom. If you're feeling frustrated as a caregiver, or if you're feeling overwhelmed, you can just take a few minutes, go to the restroom and breathe, mm-hmm. take some deep breaths, kind of reset. Caregivers are really in danger. Their health is in danger.
I believe it.
Even more, sometimes more than the person they're caring for. They can really have a lot of depression or anxiety and all of the physical symptoms that follow those symptoms. So it's really important for caregivers to find some kind of respite care and to ask for help, and ask for very specific help. Not just, hey, you know, if you're ever in the neighborhood, but say, hey, Bob, could you come over next Tuesday from 1 to 3 and watch mom, mm. you know, my mom, while I go get my nails done or go to the store or do whatever.
Right. Yeah, it's so important. I think asking for help is a big piece of it, too. Recognizing when you're at your limit. And when you need help, not after the boat's going down, but before you leave the harbor.
Absolutely.
Know? Yeah. Well, I have really enjoyed having this conversation with you. It's good to talk to someone who has an experience in this area, because I think it's a very unique one. Unless you've been with a loved one or had an experience like this, you might not know what that's like. I don't think you need one to relate to this film. The whole idea, you know, to me, the end of the day is, okay, you know, don't know what tomorrow brings, and how do you want to live your life? And every day is a new day to make that new decision and to change it. And so also, just along my whole show format here, I have some questions for Marnie, which I think she probably already knows what they are. Maybe she doesn't. Much along the lines of the Actor's Studio, James Lipton's questions, if you've ever watched the Actor's Studio. I modified them a little bit. I'm having terrible talking today. I don't know what my problem is. It's been one of those days. speaking of being real. So we are going to just go through a few questions. So the first question is, what word makes you smile?
I just thought of joy.
What word makes you cringe?
Shame.
Where is your happy place?
Oh, that's easy. In the mountains, in the Sierras.
Beautiful. What sound or noise do you love?
Birds.
What kind of birds?
I don't know. Just birds chirping.
What sound or noise do you hate?
Oh, leaf blowers.
Yeah, that's not a good one. Unless you're trying to take a nap or something. Not that that ever happens. What is the best thing about being in a relationship with you?
Oh, I'm a lot of fun.
That's good. I like the way you own that. She says laughing. If you only have an hour to yourself to do as you wish, what is your favorite thing to do?
Hiking.
Around here, where do you like to hike?
I go to Morrow Canyon and Shady Canyon and Turtle Rock and just a bunch of places locally.
It's great around here for that.
Mm-hmm.
What is your go-to emotion?
I'm actually usually pretty even keel. I mean, not for sure, not always, but when I'm not, I try to accept that too.
Embrace it. And along the lines of this show today, what is one of your favorite movies?
Wow. You'd think I'd know that right off the bat. I can't think of one right now. I'm thinking of a book.
Okay, give us that one.
Love in the Time of Cholera.
Oh, that's a great book. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, those are great answers. I like all of those. Thank you, Marnie, so much for joining me today. And thank you for listening to Love with Kim Sage today on KX at One Laguna. The show airs every Tuesday at 1 p.m., so I hope you'll continue to join me. Please feel free to always contact me with any questions or topic requests on Twitter at K-Sage Psychology. That's K-S-A-G-E Psychology. And you can always find me on my website for more information at www.kimsage.com. And Marnie, will you please tell our listeners how they can contact you?
I can be reached at www.yourocTherapist.com.
And on Twitter?
And on Twitter at Your OC Therapist.
Awesome. Those are great ones. I like those. And just thanks again to Marnie for joining me today. And to everyone, I hope that you have a beautiful day. And remember that everyone just wants to be seen, heard, and loved.